I sold my car in Carvana last night.
Well, that's cool.
No, you don't understand. It went perfectly. Real offer, down to the penny. They're picking it up tomorrow. Nothing went wrong.
So, what's the problem?
That is the problem. Nothing in my life goes as smoothly. I'm waiting for the catch.
Maybe there's no catch.
That's exactly what a catch would want me to think.
Wow, you need to relax.
I need to knock on wood. Do we have wood? Is this table wood?
I think it's laminate.
Okay, yeah, that's good. That's close enough.
Car selling without a catch. Sell your car today on
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
You know that thing where you get an amazing pair of shoes at a really great price and want to tell everyone about it? Yeah, so do we. Here at Designer Shoe Warehouse, we'll give you something to brag about. Like the latest styles from brands you love, or the trends everyone's obsessing over, or shoes that make you feel like, well, you. So go ahead, show off a little. Find shoes that get you at prices that get your budget. Head to your DSW store or DSW.com today. DSW, let us surprise you.
The so-called anti-weaponization fund, dead, a victim of political reality that could not abide this form of Trumpian retribution. The political pallbearers, Republicans. California's primary is tomorrow. Despite big races for governor and mayor of Los Angeles, turnout is lower than previous elections. Are voters discouraged or discerning? TMZ, it is an acronym. Do you know what it means? Well, we will tell you. And as we do, we will welcome reporters from the TV show's brand new DC Bureau to see what they are up to in the nation's capital. Hello, everyone. I'm Major Garrett in Washington. Welcome to The Takeout. Now, you know I think about this show as a continuous conversation. That's not the way most TV shows go. But hello, this is not most TV shows, right? Short time ago on this program, I opened up wondering about what I called YOLO Republicans, those freshly defeated Republicans bulldozed in primaries by MAGA favorites endorsed by President Trump. Would they rebel, I wondered? Would they threaten Trump's agenda? The Wall Street Journal, which I read with relish, outdid my YOLO Republican terminology, came up with a new term, wounded bear Republicans. Today's news about the now defunct, and I mean really defunct, anti-weaponization fund to me conjures up a hybrid Republican renegade, the YOLO wounded bear. All weekend, the White House said it was not budging an inch on the phone, said the $1.8 billion set aside was legally valid and politically defensible. This despite ample and vocal GOP resistance to it on substantive, legal, and political grounds. Then came Trump's meeting today at the White House with House Speaker Mike Johnson, hardly a YOLO wounded bear. Johnson, quite to the contrary, is an assiduous and skilled herdsman of loyal and wayward Republicans, Freedom Caucus members, Problem Solver Caucus members, YOLO Republicans, wounded bear Republicans, and taxonomies yet to be identified. Johnson has to count votes and count them precisely. He only has two to spare. After Trump met with Johnson, came word the White House would abandon the fund. The proximate reason? A judicial ruling blocking it. Oh, wow. As if a judicial ruling blocking something this White House set in motion had ever stopped or slowed it down before. Republicans stopped this cold. To use a phrase from just last week, that was the final determination. With the story, we turn now to Ed O'Keefe at the White House. Ed, tell us what you know.
I mean, you nailed it there. It was a telling signal this morning when we got word the House Speaker was coming over here. He doesn't come over here that often by himself. And even if he ever does, they don't necessarily always announce it. So that was a signal that something more was coming from congressional Republicans regarding all this. And remember, the underlying issue here is congressional Republicans are being asked to do here in this final summer stretch a big thing, and that is to pass with a mechanism that only requires Republican votes, spending legislation that essentially takes care of the last remaining big priorities of this administration before the elections when they may lose control of one or both chambers. And the biggest priority, of course, is immigration funding. The hope is to put hundreds of billions of dollars in place for ICE and CBP for the next several years. And the White House started adding things. Oh, we need money for the security and the reconstruction of the East Wing over here, which the president says is going to include a drone port. And then came word 2 weeks ago that in a settlement with the IRS, by the way, we're establishing an anti-weaponization fund where we're going to dole out $1.776 billion dollars to people who say they were mistreated by the federal government. But in that meeting that Senate Republicans had with the acting attorney general back on May 21st, he couldn't commit to ensuring that the money would never go to those who had beat up, assaulted, and really just made miserable the lives of police officers on January 6, 2021, during the insurrection at the Capitol. And it was that that prompted the sustained Republican concern and opposition to this, reflected on Sunday on Face the Nation by Vice President Mike Pence, who, of course, was a target on January 6th, and others across the Republican spectrum saying, we can't do this when you're asking us to do the other things. And, oh, by the way, his approval ratings are slipping, and there's growing concern we're going to be able to win our reelections this fall when it's bad enough you're asking us to take the tricky vote in some parts of the country to support immigration policy that resulted in the death of two people earlier this year and led to the swift and sudden ongoing collapse of the president's approval rating. So, as you said, it's correct to say in this case, Republicans forced the president to back away from this, and they have done so in a pretty remarkable way with this Justice Department statement saying we're not going to comply with a court order. This is a Justice Department that's been pined to fight for any court ruling that goes against the president's wishes. But again, the pressure was just too much from fellow Republicans.
Ed O'Keefe at the White House, as always, sir, thank you very much. Now to Iran. On social media, President Trump said this afternoon that peace talks with Iran are continuing at a, quote, rapid pace. However, Iranian state media says negotiations are suspended. And earlier in the day, the president acknowledged as much. It was all very confusing. CBS News national security analyst Aaron McClain joins me now. He also hosts the most excellent School of War podcast. Aaron, if you were following interviews the president conducted with NBC, then CNBC, and watching a social media feed, your neck was literally snapped in every single direction. Because at one point this morning, the president said, oh, I hadn't heard that the Iranians had suspended it. Oh, that's okay with me. They were getting boring anyway. Silence is all right. Then he said, I'm going to talk to the Israeli prime minister and see what's going on in Lebanon, as if the president of the United States doesn't know what's going on in Lebanon. Try to help us understand what is or isn't real here.
Yeah, the noise to signal ratio today, Major, was heavily in favor of noise. Don't forget, you left out that at one point the president declared that a ceasefire was in place between Hezbollah and the IDF in southern Lebanon, only to see Prime Minister Netanyahu say on social media shortly after that that actually Israeli forces would continue to do what they're going to do in southern Lebanon and held open the possibility of strikes in Beirut if Hezbollah continued to strike them. You know, I would say stepping back, the overall appearance was that the president was eager to keep the negotiations with Iran going. Why? Probably because he's worried about the markets. He needs the markets to stay in a good position for him. And if talks genuinely pause or even collapse, that's bad.
And Aaron, one of the ways you can tell how those who have a financial skin in the game are actually reacting to reality, whether the president is characterizing reality or not, is the oil markets, and they traded up. Brent crude was up almost $4.50. West Texas Intermediate up more than $5 today. That means they are anticipating things being possibly more hostile than not.
Yeah, and look, I mean, I think a lot of observers of commodities markets, the energy markets, are surprised, actually, that things are holding together more or less as well as they are so far. It does have kind of the feeling
meaning
of,
it's near 100, it's not 150, not 180.
Or 200. I mean, it does feel a bit like Wile E. Coyote when he runs off the cliff and his feet keep spinning, right, but he's still in air. We just, that the floor has not fallen out yet, or the roof, because the price will go up, has not yet blown off.
And let's talk about Lebanon for a second. I want to play for our audience something that I know you remember the president saying on May 20th, talking to reporters outside of Air Force One. He said this about his relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister. Play it.
He'll do whatever I want him to do. He's a very, very good man. He'll do whatever I want him to do.
Okay. The Iranians have made it clear that cessation of hostilities in Lebanon is what they consider to be consistent with an overall ceasefire. And violations there, meaning it's all off, meaning things could restart again, meaning the Strait of Hormuz, right, becomes more complicated. Analyze that for us, because what the Israelis did over the weekend was to go farther in Lebanon than they'd been for 26 years.
That's right. They've been pushing north. They took this old Crusader castle, the Beaufort Castle, which stands on this commanding terrain overlooking the Latani River. Look, the president likes to say things like that. He doesn't like other world leaders to be perceived as equals, generally speaking. But that's not very good for Prime Minister Netanyahu politically at home. He, of course, needs to project strength to his own domestic political constituency. And by the way, these Iranian calls for a ceasefire in Lebanon are fairly convenient insofar as Hezbollah, not so great at abiding by the terms of ceasefires, pretty good at shooting at Israeli troops who are operating north of this border. They're in a real dilemma there. If they come back south of the border like they were before October the 7th, Hezbollah builds up its combat power. If they go north of the border and occupy in the long run, as they have in the past, Hezbollah hammers Israeli troops north of the border. It's not a great choice.
Let's do a quick numbers level set on the Strait of Hormuz. It was reported today and confirmed by us that the U.S. Navy has been quietly escorting a small number of vessels through the Strait of Hormuz. I believe it's an average of three per day.
Yeah.
Is that meaningful?
Well, to quote a great Martin Scorsese movie, The Wolf of Wall Street, those are rookie numbers. You got to get those numbers way up. Three or four a day. Keep in mind, the pre-war number was 130 to 140 a day. So is this meaningful at the margins? Maybe a little bit in combination with, you know, you have Saudi, you have the UAE shipping oil through pipelines to other terminuses. You have freight being taken across the continent on trucks. There's all sorts of ways in which you can kind of mitigate the closure of the strait. But no, three ships a day ain't going to do it.
We love all references to movies, especially Martin Scorsese movies. Aaron McClain, thank you very much. Maine's presumptive Democratic nominee for Senate, Graham Platner, had one of the toughest weekends of his campaign, and that's saying something. It was, again, about his personal life. And the disclosures, well, they don't get much more personal than the ones that arrived this weekend. In 2025, according to the reports, Platner's wife, Amy Gertner, told his campaign internally about her knowledge of sexually explicit messages her husband exchanged with several other women. This happened, she disclosed, again, within the confines of the campaign while they were married. The campaign, by way of response, posted this video from Gertner.
No marriage is perfect, and I don't want a perfect marriage. I want my marriage, and I want to be married to Graham.
The question, can Platner's ability, which has been pretty consistent throughout this campaign, to face down questions about his conduct and his character, continue? Artorian Small joins me now with some late-breaking developments from Capitol Hill. As I understand it, Torian, Graham Platner is going to be coming to Washington.
Yeah, according to sources familiar, he sat to meet with Senate Democrats ahead of a planned fundraiser he's set to have tomorrow here in the Capitol as well. It's interesting because a lot of these Democrats have been quite precarious about his campaign so far. He's been rattled by scandal after scandal, the most latest being this sexting scandal that he and his wife admitted to. I want to call into question or call out some of the responses that we heard from Democrats or lack of responses. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer just made it to the Capitol a couple of hours ago, and he said not now when repeatedly pressed on whether or not he wanted to give a statement on his confidence in Platner. Over the weekend, we heard from some Democrats like Senator Chris Murphy, who was on Face the Nation. He said there's still a clear contrast between Platner and President Trump, and he said he still believes he's the best candidate for this seat. And as we know, he's running unopposed, considering his primary opponent, the current governor of Maine, dropped out. So it looks like you said, he's the presumptive nominee and he's still likely to win his primary.
And I guess the big question behind all this, Torian, is are there more disclosures to come? And is there something about Graham Platner that Maine voters have yet to hear? Because they've heard plenty and he has withstood a lot of this scrutiny so far. But is there another shoe or set of shoes to drop? And it seems like that's what Democrats are nervously talking about privately.
Major, it's curious timing, right? I mean, the fact that he's running essentially unopposed in his primary for this to drop would suggest that there's potentially more dirt out there that could come out. He's certainly not alluding to it. And in fact, he's saying that this is a problem drummed up by the media when addressing this. His campaign, his wife have been pretty rabid in their attacks on the press for reporting this story. But he still has several months to go after his primary, and it's likely especially that his Republican opponent, Senator Susan Collins, will seize on this opportunity to point to voters who exactly he is. This is a tough race for him, considering she has the incumbent's advantage. And even though Democrats are designating this seat as one to flip, this could present a larger challenge. The bigger question is how he would face, if elected, coming into a very different Capitol Hill. We saw the ousters of several congressmen just this year alone for related or similar sexual misconduct allegations. There's on the House side a task force, bipartisan task force, looked at addressing sexual misconduct reporting. So whether or not his behavior will face the ire of Democrats is something that we'll get a readout on tomorrow when he meets with some of those Democratic lawmakers.
Attorney Small on Capitol Hill, thank you very much. Now to Africa, where confirmed Ebola cases continue to rise in the Democratic Republic of Congo. There's also some good news. The World Health Organization confirmed today 5 infected patients have recovered. Now, mortality rates are closely watched because this particular strain of Ebola does not have an approved vaccine, at least not yet. I want to bring in CBS News medical correspondent Dr. Celine Gounder. Quick reminder, she's an infectious disease specialist who spent time in Guinea as an Ebola worker during the West African epidemic. Dr. Gounder, always a pleasure to have you with us. Let's start with the good news. How encouraging or relevant is it about these 5 cases that seem to work in the right direction?
Well, look, if you have a case fatality rate of, let's say, 25-30%, that means the other 75% or so are going to survive. So you're going to have some survivors from this, even with just supportive care. We do know the patient in Berlin, the American who was flown, evacuated to Berlin, received monoclonal antibodies, and that his PCR, so that's a measure of the viral load, the amount of virus in the blood, dropped dramatically after receiving that experimental monoclonal antibody. You may remember monoclonal antibodies from COVID. The problem with those require IV infusion. They are difficult to produce at mass, at scale, and they're very expensive. So even if this particular experimental monoclonal works, we still have more testing to do and then need to be able to scale up capacity and do so at an affordable cost.
Dr. Gounder, we talked last week about this quarantine facility in Kenya that is to be stood up by the United States government. It was blocked by a Kenyan court late last week. There were protests, as I understand it. What's the status?
Yeah, so hundreds of young Kenyans marched to the gates of Laikipia Air Base. This is the air base where they were building the quarantine facility. So you had Kenyan soldiers patrolling in tanks. Anti-riot police were being deployed. The local governor of the area said the facility will expose his people to Ebola. And he has a point. Many of the local people work on that airbase. And then Thursday, as you mentioned, the Kenyan High Court blocked the facility, calling it a threat to Kenyan life. By Saturday, American health officers had already landed at the base anyway. And then Kenya's health minister claimed the facility is for everyone, not just Americans. So you have a facility that the court said can't operate. You have American staff on the ground, and you have Kenyan protesters at the gates.
Is this why in the past, Dr. Gounder, these things were not stood up and Americans were simply flown to America?
Well, you have whether it's an American health aid worker or an American soldier, don't you want them to get the best possible medical care if they are injured, if they develop an illness in the course of service? And the best way to do that is as early in their course of illness, whatever the cause, as possible before they deteriorate. And so to send them to a Kenyan facility that is being stood up ad hoc at the last second without all of the normal infection control capacities, the normal kinds of equipment that you would want, for example, being able to put somebody on a ventilator, being able to give them dialysis, being able to give them heart-lung bypass. That's not going to be the kind of care they're going to provide there. And so you're basically dooming them to this middle tier of care in a field hospital when they should be flown to the very best that we have built here in the U.S. over more than a decade with billions of dollars. We have built the capacity to treat patients just like this.
Dr. Celine Gounder, appreciate it as always. Thank you. Still to come, new Trump administration plans to speed up denial of asylum claims. CBS's Camila Montoya-Galvez shares his exclusive reporting. Plus, we take you to California ahead of tomorrow's primary, a check-in on the race for governor and Los Angeles mayor. Plus, TMZ may be new to Capitol Hill, but it has already made its presence known. Two members of TMZ's Washington Bureau join me. Take our returns in 90 seconds.
Hi, it's Sierra Miller. I can't wait for you to check out my new collection of shoes and accessories at Designer Shoe Warehouse. If you love shoes as much as I do, then trust me, I got you. From cute sneakerinas to the perfect flip-flops to stunning heels, these shoes are all style, no drama. It's a girl's girl summer, and DSW has just the shoes. Shop the Sierra Miller collection right now at your DSW store or DSW.com.
There's never been a better time to get outside and experience the benefits of nature. Discover nearby trails and explore the outdoors with AllTrails. Download the free app today and find your outside.
Welcome back to The Takeout. CBS News has learned exclusively the Trump administration is putting together a plan that would allow immigration officials to swiftly reject some asylum applications without ever interviewing the applicant. CBS News immigration correspondent Camila Montoya-Galvez has the new reporting. Lay it out for us, Camila.
Well, Major, just to level set, every time somebody files an asylum request here in the U.S., the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, specifically an asylum officer at USCIS, a branch of DHS, interviews that applicant to, one, determine whether that person meets the legal definition of a refugee, an asylee, and also to determine whether that person perhaps poses a threat to national security or public safety. But now, according to the internal DHS documents that we obtained, the administration is drafting a regulation that would empower asylum officers to quickly and expeditiously reject asylum applications without actually interviewing the applicants. And asylum officers would be empowered to do so if they find that that application was filed a year after that person entered the country. That has been longstanding federal law that you, generally speaking, have to file your asylum case within the first year of your arrival to the country. But now, asylum applicants will not be allowed to explain why perhaps they did not follow that one-year deadline during an interview and could be quickly rejected from the get-go, and their cases could be sent directly to the immigration courts, which now have to oversee adversarial cases that are much harder to win by the Justice Department. And we should underscore, Major, lastly, that this is part of a broader campaign by the administration to restrict access to the asylum system, which officials argue faces systematic abuse and fraud.
And very quickly, Camilo, over the weekend and days before that, at a place called Delaney, a facility for detention of those possibly to be deported, there have been protests, clashes, and the like. What has happened? What's the current status?
Well, we have seen tent protests outside of the Delaney Hall ICE detention facility in Newark, New Jersey. That started after an alleged hunger strike on Memorial Day by detainees who were complaining, allegedly, Major, about substandard conditions at the facility. Over the weekend, law enforcement officials were able to reassert control of the situation to a higher degree, at least, and to establish a perimeter around the facility. And that was after the governor of New Jersey, a Democrat, Mikey Sherrill, ordered additional state troopers to go there to set up that perimeter. Now the Department of Homeland Security has allowed the facility to be reopened for family visitation for the relatives of detainees to go inside to talk to the relatives. That had been suspended because of the protests. But again, clashes and protests have continued now for 10 straight days.
Major. And quickly, Camilo, there's a curfew that's been imposed.
Yes, the mayor of Newark, Ross Baraka, has imposed a curfew near the facility from 9 p.m. at night to 6 a.m. in the morning.
Camila Montoya-Galvez, with all the stuff, as always, thank you very much. The artificial intelligence battle heats up on Wall Street. Anthropic's move that has a nearly trillion-dollar company prepared to go public as soon as this fall. We'll have the details when we come back. You're watching The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. Welcome to the Conversation Corner. Here is a look at what else we and now you are watching this evening. There's a new chapter opening in the artificial intelligence profit race on Wall Street. Today, Anthropic announced that it had submitted a confidential filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission for a proposed initial public stock offering. The company says it has not decided on the price of shares. The artificial intelligence behemoth is valued at nearly $1 trillion and could become the second or third largest initial public offering in American history. Its rival, OpenAI, valued at $850 billion, but it has not yet filed its paperwork, though it is intending to do so, with the SEC about its own initial public offering. A former Colorado County clerk convicted in an election fraud scheme is out of prison today. In 2023, Tina Peters was found guilty of breaching voting systems in search of unfounded election fraud claims and evidence. Last month, Democratic Governor Jared Polis commuted her sentence after pressure from President Trump. Shortly after her release, Peters repeated a debunked conspiracy theory that voting machines cheated Trump out of winning re-election in 2020. We are about 24 hours away from several very high-profile primaries in California. The governor's race and the Los Angeles mayor's race are two of the biggest, along with several congressional contests, which will be conducted under newly redrawn district lines. Now, according to Political Data Incorporated, more than 3.5 million mail-in ballots have already been cast. Compared to 2022, the number of Democrats who voted early, down 2%. The number of Republicans voting early, up 2%. Melanie Mason joins me now. She is the California Bureau Chief for Politico and co-author of Politico's much-read, at least by me, California Playbook. Melanie, it's great to have you with us. Do some quick numbers. 23 million registered voters in California, 45% of them registered Democrats, 26.7% registered independents, 25% registered Republicans. What, if anything, do these early vote totals suggest to you?
Well, it suggests a couple of things. The first is the fact that we saw Democratic voters hold on to their ballots for so long, that the numbers that you just showed from Political Data really show that it seemed like Democrats didn't know where to touch down on this race, and particularly the governor's race. And so we saw them holding on to their ballots quite late. And I think that that means that we're probably in for a long night tomorrow, because these late mail ballots coming in means it might be days really before we know what the outcome will be. But I think it just speaks to the very unsettled nature of this race. I mean, remember just 6 weeks ago or so that we were all talking about former Congressman Eric Swalwell as the likely front runner of this race. Now we are looking at this race between Javier Becerra, who really kind of came out of nowhere, Tom Steyer, who has been spending well over $200 million on this campaign, and Steve Hilton, the Republican, who has the backing of President Trump, and then a whole lot of other candidates, including some like pretty significant Democrats, people like Katie Porter and Antonio Villaraigosa. So it's been a confusing race. And I think the fact that Democratic voters have been holding onto their ballots as long as they have just sort of shows that people didn't glom onto a candidate particularly early.
Two questions, and they are procedural. One, 61 names on the ballot for California governor. That's got to be injecting some manner of confusion into the process of finding the candidate you actually want to vote for. And second, convey to my audience as a quick reminder what the top two primary format in California means.
That's right. Well, I'll take that second one first. So California has this top two primary, which means that regardless of party, the top two vote getters will advance in these primaries into November. And that caused a lot of panic, particularly for Democrats early on, because they were seeing so many Democratic candidates, Democratic voters fractured among all of these candidates. And meanwhile, there are two Republicans who were consistently polling at the top of the polls. And Democrats thought in a state where they have such a registration advantage that there was a possibility that they would be boxed out of the top two entirely. That is almost certainly not going to happen now. We have seen the race sort of reshape itself over the last couple of weeks. In fact, it is possible we might see two Democrats advance instead. But that top two primary has given a lot of heartburn to Democrats. In fact, there's now a new effort to repeal that, to sort of roll that back, because I think Democratic operatives were so twisted up in knots over the possibility that they could have egg over their face and not have a candidate in this race. And yes, to your point about the ballot, it is a long one. And I actually am kind of going to be fascinated to see, because, you know, in polls, they're polling the top the top candidates, right? I mean, they're not going to be asking people about 61 candidates. But, you know, it is a little bit of an X factor when you have folks who are, for example, there's a man named Barack D. Obama Shaw who is on the ballot. Does he get a lot of votes or some votes at least because he has a recognizable name? So it adds another kind of weird twist to this race. But I guess it wouldn't be California if there weren't some wonky things that are happening in the elections. And I think that the length of the ballot is an underappreciated one.
And quickly on the Los Angeles mayor's race, what are you watching for there? And do you think there'll be a known victor after Tuesday night?
I think that it is unlikely that we will have a sense of who the top two are that are advancing. It's possible that we might see who has sort of established enough of a lead to secure sort of that first place. But look, what we've watched in this race is kind of this amazing national spectacle around Spencer Pratt, who is this, you know, reality TV star who lost his home in the Palisades fire last year and really has become this phenomenon online for his candidacy. You know, there's a lot of very loud, very vocal Spencer Pratt supporters. You know, we see them online all the time. And I hear it in, you know, in California, in Los Angeles. But at the same time, it's also a lot of people outside of the state, right? If you see tweets about him, they'll say, you know, if only I were in Los Angeles and could vote for you. So I think we're waiting to see how much of the Pratt phenomenon is sort of generated outside of the LA voter base. Or as he claims, are there hidden Pratt voters, Democrats or independent voters who maybe wouldn't align with him politically, but are so frustrated with the state of the city that they might say, well, let's try a change. The one thing I will note is that it is very likely that he will jump out to a pretty early lead because of the way that the votes are counted, because Republicans either had turned in their ballots earlier than Democrats, or they tend to show up more on election day. And what we've seen consistently, not just in this race, but in others, is that the vote starts out kind of tilting more red. And then as these late ballots come in and are counted, it tends to shift more blue. So every election cycle, people rediscover that that's the pattern. And we'll have to remind people that that's not because of anything nefarious going on. It's just the nature of who votes when in these all-male elections. And it tends to be that the Democratic voters are doing this late mail and therefore are counted later in the count.
Yes, mail spelled M-A-I-L. Melanie Mason, Politico. Yes. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, President Trump weighs in on the primary for South Carolina governor on the Republican side, and it's not good news for Congresswoman Nancy Mace. What challenges does she face ahead? Our political panel will discuss that and a lot more next on The Ticket.
At DSW, we ask the important questions, like, what shoes are you going to wear? Whether you're prepping for wedding season, festival season, or just planning the ultimate vacay, the right shoes can make or break an RSVP. So own the moment. You've got big plans, and we've got just the shoes. At the perfect price, of course. Get ready to get ready with Designer Shoe Warehouse. Head to your DSW store or DSW.com today, and let us surprise you.
Why have I asked my HVAC guy I found on Angie.com to change my grandpa's trachea tube? Because I was so amazed by how quickly he replaced our air ducts. I knew I could trust him to change Pop-Pop's tube while I was on vacation.
Make it quick, young man.
Aw, see? Pop-Pop trusts you.
I think we should call a doctor.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
Welcome back. Political panel time. Let me introduce them. Harrison Fields, former White House Deputy Press Secretary under President Trump, making his first takeout appearance as a CBS News political contributor. Dan Cannon is a Democratic strategist, former Battleground States Director for Kamala Harris's presidential campaign. Welcome to you both. Harrison, congrats. Good
Thank
to have you aboard. Let's talk about Nancy Mace. The iron rule here is if I go to it before we go to break, we have to bring it in when I first come back. So she was running fifth of five Republicans in the governor's race in South Carolina. Not a huge surprise she doesn't get the endorsement from President Trump. Interestingly, on social media, she posts that the proximate cause may have been her pressing for transparency in the Epstein files matter, saying, if this is the price of an endorsement, I will never pay it. How do you think that's going to go down, Harrison?
Yeah, when all else fails, sometimes people resort to being a sore loser. It was very clear based on the polls
where the president endorsement was going to go. The lieutenant governor is extremely qualified here. The governor endorsed her as well.
Pamela Everett is the lieutenant Pamela governor. Everett. And the governor, as you said, Henry McMaster, had endorsed her months before. That was right. Kind of a tell because he and the president very close.
Very close. Yeah. So I think there was no surprises out of this race. And, you know, there's a lot of conversations about the president's endorsements now. His endorsement rate is probably
within the Republican Party. It is absolute. Yeah.
He's batting 1,000.
Nearly 1,000.
And, you know, there was a little consternation about his decision in Texas. For a lot of South Carolinians who are looking at the president for this level of endorsement, they're probably breathing a sigh of relief. Nancy Mace would have made that race a little bit more complicated. I wish her well. I know she's very dedicated in a lot of different tasks that she goes out with, especially defending women. But this race is going to be clear, and it'll be Governor Everett very soon.
Dan, I want to give you a chance to talk about however much you want to talk about what happened with Graham Plattner's campaign over the weekend. Related to that, a few moments ago, Janet Mills, governor of Maine, mm-hmm. was in the race, mm-hmm. suspended her campaign. She just put out a quick sort of milquetoast reminder. People have the impression that I withdrew or dropped out, but I simply suspended my active campaigning. I'm still on the ballot.
Yeah.
How do you think this weekend's events, Graham Plattner's reaction, which was a little more unsteady than he'd responded to other things, puts the race?
Well, I think there was a really good reason, evidently, why Chuck Schumer, the DSCC, was pushing for an alternative
Democratic
candidate.
Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, yes.
And you know, there was on the left...
Pushing
Janet Mills hard. And on the left, in the online left especially, there was consternation about the DS, Chuck Schumer's committee, putting his thumb on the scale in
the
that
establishment,
race.
The establishment.
You know, obviously, I think they saw something in Plattner that was concerning, and we'll see what the voters say about this. Now, Plattner, to date, has weathered a lot of criticism and critiques.
Right.
It is unclear how this will play with voters. I'd say that truly, one way or the other, we'll see. He's got to answer for this. His wife had a video that was compelling, but he's got to now speak to this and convince people that he can be trusted based on not just his behavior, but the idea that this is another shoe dropping and what else might
be
dropping.
Are there more shoes?
Yes. Now, I've said this a lot, but 2006 was a fight election. The Iraq War, kick him out, just change the guard, right? 2008 was the turn the page. If 2026 is purely about the fight, perhaps Plattner can survive this. But if he's got to convince people in the middle to trust him, he's going to have a harder time.
That's, I think, very cogent analysis. I want to talk to you, Harrison, about Los Angeles mayor's race, because Melanie Mason, just on from Political Race, I think a really important point. Spencer Pratt has this tremendous, well-earned viral reputation. Can that translate on the ground for Los Angeles mayoral voters, not just the online community, many of whom don't even live in California? What do you think?
I think it could. I think people in Los Angeles are desperate for change. There's a reason why his candidacy kind of came forth. It's because he dealt with incompetence at the local level following that devastating Palisades fire. So you have a lot of people in Los Angeles that are wanting change. He could certainly be it. Karen Bass has a lot to answer to her constituents.
As I brought up last week, the number one polling complaint in Los Angeles was corruption in city government. That cannot be a good place for an incumbent to be.
At all.
Dan?
It's not, and it's not just the mayor's race. Jake Levine is a Democrat running in a primary against a sitting member of Congress, Brad Sherman, who Jake would say he's from Palisades. He watched the city and his members of Congress not respond aggressively enough, with enough force, enough speed to that incident, and then looked at decades of not taking care of business. And so besides the mayor's race, there's maybe members of Congress on the Democratic side who will lose their seats if a guy like Jake gets through the top two and is a serious challenge in the fall.
I want to ask you about the former first lady. Mm-hmm. She's got a book out. She did a very heavily publicized, at least here, interview with CBS Sunday Morning, talking about the debate performance, her sense of it. How do you absorb what the former first lady is saying about decisions made, her role in them?
Well, you know, I watched Andy Beshear speak this weekend to this
Kentucky governor,
point.
Democrat.
Yep. And I think he had one of the most cogent answers here possible. You're looking at someone who is a first lady, a wife who loves her husband very much and is going to defend him always. And it's hard to critique that. Now, I always felt like, as someone who worked for Joe Biden on the campaign and then Kamala Harris, by the way, I wouldn't recommend doing two candidates top of the ticket. That's my tip to you, Harrison. That what we were dealt with is the choice between an open primary, which went very badly in 2019 for Democrats. It was a mess. Kamala Harris, who wasn't polling well and wasn't quite ready in the estimation of the president. Or do I have enough left in the fastball? And I think he thought he did. I think the first lady thought he did. And then in that moment, he hung the curve of all curves.
And in the debate.
And so I think all of that we are seeing from her, maybe not well said in terms of the words and how she chose the words, but that was just the reality of the experience. I think he could do this, and then he couldn't. And that was the end of it.
Dan Cannon, great stuff. I appreciate the candor. Harrison Fields, welcome aboard.
Thank you.
We'll see you here again. I hope we'll see you back here
anytime.
Again. To the best set on television, everybody knows it. Coming up, one of Hollywood's most powerful and feared tabloids is making waves in the nation's capital. Next, I'll be joined by the managing editors of TMZ, DC. That's next here on The Takeout. Welcome back. Super stoked about this segment to come, but hold on, prompter operator. Hold on. I'm going to tell you something that you don't know. Most of you don't know. Do you know what TMZ stands for? TMZ stand. I know the show. No. 30 mile zone. What is that? Early in Hollywood, 30 mile zone was the area designated by Hollywood that set per diem, travel compensation, and work rules. That's how Hollywood controlled cost in its early days. And it's kind of been a part of the Hollywood process for how you pay and compensate people, and also how you control the payment and compensation of people who work in the industry. So that, you're welcome, is what TMZ means. Mm. Over the last couple of months, TMZ, you know what it is, it's a TV show, thrown its hat into the DC journalistic fray, expanding its presence on Capitol Hill. Take a look for yourself.
Why don't you broker a deal right now with TMZ? Say we pass ICE funding, but no more masks, and you have to have a search warrant. Deal or no deal?
How are you feeling today? You feeling all right?
Were you worried at all when Joe Biden was weaponizing the Department of Justice?
I don't want to talk about Joe Biden, sir.
I know you don't. I understand you got a political agenda.
No, I just don't want to pay January 6th riders.
Look, I get. You get to ask a question.
Can I answer?
To give the answer. I'm giving you my answer.
Are you going to answer the question, sir?
I have answered.
You didn't.
It's just not consistent.
Do you think the January 6th riders are eligible for the slush fund? Thanks, Ted.
Joining me now, the most well-dressed managing editors of TMZ DC, Jacob Wasserman and Charlie Cotton. You're Charlie, you're Jacob.
That's
it's great to have you here at The Takeout. Welcome.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
So what is the TMZ approach on Capitol Hill? What is your secret sauce, Charlie?
We want to hold members of Congress accountable, primarily. We want greater transparency in DC, just like everybody else does. But we also want to sort of like see these people as people rather than politicians as well. A lot of America isn't well acquainted with the politicians who control their lives. So some of the battle is kind of introducing them. And then if there's like a story that we got to ask about, it's about trying to get answers from some people who might be reluctant to give them.
And Jacob, it's about piercing the veil of civility in this town. Like there's, well, you can't ask about that. How dare you? And don't get into the nitty-gritty of who I am. You guys want to get into the nitty-gritty.
Yeah, well, I think we're just trying to talk like normal people. Like, you know, people talk
not like
about
a Washingtonian like me.
Yeah, not
well,
like
well,
you.
You're far more nuanced. It's like people talk about politics at bars, at town hall meetings, and we're just taking that exact same style and delivering it on the Hill.
So is it Hollywood coming to D.C. or is it D.C. in a different way?
Well, I mean, the number one catchphrase I've heard around town is that DC is just Hollywood for ugly people.
The very old cliche.
Have you heard that?
I have.
And I got to say,
present company
excluded.
No, it's tearing DC.
Come on. This is my moneymaker right here, okay?
But I will say,
not much money, but
politicians want to be famous more than famous people.
Right.
Which helps our cause. And also, we have an audience which isn't as politically minded as, say, you know, your show or other shows.
You've learned some diplomacy already.
Yeah.
And Jacob, that's really it, because celebrity, visibility, and sort of traction in the larger media world is differently measured now than it was even 10 years ago. And you guys are a pathway to that.
Well, what was so important in the 2024 election? Was about who could hang out on a podcast. We saw Donald Trump going on Andrew Schultz, Theo Vaughn, and Kamala Harris, too, is trying to go on Alex Cooper and a lot of these other shows. And it's because politicians want to show people that they're just like you. They can hang, you know, they can have a beer with you. And now they can have, instead of going to a podcast studio and taking a lot of time out of their busy schedule, They could just talk to me and Charlie on the Hill, which takes no more than 2 minutes out of their day. And I think really is able to land with people in their district and across the country.
Do you have your credentials yet?
Yes.
Oh, all right. That's good. You got your credentials.
Oh, it's amazing to have credentials.
So now you get to walk around. You get to all the spaces. Yeah. All right. So walk me through a morning conversation at TMZ. Is there a time when you say routinely, most of the press corps isn't even going to go after that, but that's a hook story for us. We're going in that direction.
Yeah, I think we have a different perspective on what is news today than a major network. But I also think there are some glaringly obvious stories that you've got to talk about, which are very much in the news. So we will just kind of like, we want almost the intersection of politics and pop culture sometimes.
Hello, that's what
we're
talking about. Hello.
We've been finding that a lot.
And when you have traveled around Capitol Hill, are you recognizable to members yet, Jake?
Yes. It's at the point now where people are coming up to us and they're saying, we want to talk. We want to talk about X, Y, Z, or I saw this. Like, let's talk to my person. We get that all the time.
Right. Are the things that they want to talk to you about, like, super boring?
Yeah.
Sometimes.
A lot of the times if they'll come up to us with a pitch, maybe it won't be like, you know, is it TMZ? Is it? Because we, you know, we got a different way of doing news.
This is TMZ, not PBS. Remember.
Sometimes that's what I think.
But also, to their credit, too, I think sometimes they're getting grilled on policy questions. And when we come and ask them the pop culture question, it's almost like a sigh of relief. But with that, they actually give some pretty interesting answers. And I feel like can talk more freely than maybe with other media members.
How many people love your Aussie accent, bro?
All of you.
It's
every single one of you.
It's actually incredible. Because it's like if I'm filming with someone and I'm like, oh, I get to go in the elevator with you, it doesn't land. But if he's like, oh, well, I get to go in the elevator, it sounds more genuine. You know, it just sounds like more genuine.
I'm not listening to my executive producer. What did you just say? Gotta go? Oh, gotta go.
No, sorry.
Charlie.
Hi. Thank you very much for having us, man.
Gary. Thank you.
Appreciate you.
Awesome. You'll come back.
Absolutely.
Happy Monday, everyone. Take out. You know where we are. Relentlessly curious, reliably civil, occasionally clever.
Are you really buying a car online on AutoTrader right now?
Really? I can get super specific with dealer listings and see cars based on my budget.
Mom! You can really have it delivered.
Or pick it up.
Mommy, look!
I think your kid is walking up the slide.
Really?
AutoTrader. Buy your car online. Really?
Now streaming on Paramount Plus. Beth and Rip are back in Dutton Ranch.
This life here is gonna work, isn't it?
We'll make it work.
Starring Kelly Riley.
A legacy is a beautiful thing, but only if it survives.
Cole Hauser.
Let's go to work.
Ed Harris.
Family is the only thing worth fighting for.
And Annette Bening.
I can make this a lot harder for all y'all.
And peace will have to wait.
Dutton Ranch, new series now streaming on Paramount Plus.